I've always appreciated the insight of a little girl who asked a question, a significant question. She was having dinner with her parents, and they had a dinner guest. This story has been around the church a long time, but it's one I think that we continue to find benefit from. The guest at their dinner table was Daddy's boss, and he was a big sort of fellow who shook the table with his laughter and talked an awful lot. He talked and talked and talked. Now, this little one, Lizzie, had been briefed by her parents to be on her best behavior while Daddy's boss was there for dinner. As she listened to the man talk, though, she heard him brag about himself over and over again, and he kept using the same phrase, "Well, you realize I'm a self-made man." "Well, you realize I'm a self-made man." "Well, you know, I'm a self-made man." And finally, Lizzie could not stand it any longer, and she looked to her dad and broke the silence with the question, "Daddy, if he really is a self-made man, why did he make himself that way?" For most of us, that's how we relate to the rich man in Jesus' story. Since Sunday school, we have detested this guy. I baptized a lot of babies in my ministry, but I never baptized one named Dives by his parents. I know of no one who looks at this text and says, "Now that's my hero, that rich guy." As Jesus describes him, he is very much a wealthy man who wants people to know that he's a wealthy man. The purple robe he wore probably was made of costly dye from seashells. The linen mentioned was probably his underwear, made of the richest cotton from Egypt. This was a guy who looked good all over and felt good all under. His sumptuous daily feast went on, which shows him to care very little about Judaism or its Sabbath laws. The gate mentioned in the text probably was meant to keep the riffraff out, people like this Lazarus. Boy, the poor can sure be a nuisance sometimes. And the dogs mentioned were probably guard dogs, there for the same purpose, but who turned soft and antiseptic with Lazarus. Jesus gives enough of a description of this guy for us to realize this is someone who loves being rich and loves having people know that he's rich. So it's no wonder that when you and I read a text like this, we just love the reversals in this text. It's very much in vogue, you know, to look at reversals, to look how things get turned topsy-turvy. And this story has quite a few, and we love them all. Rich man with daily gourmet meal becomes beggar, saying what beggars say, "Have mercy on me." Lazarus in pain becomes Lazarus in ecstasy, while rich man in ecstasy becomes man in agony. Lazarus, once on the outside, gets on the inside. Rich man, once on the inside, is now on the outside. Lazarus, who suffered evil on earth, gets good in heaven. Rich man, who got good on earth, suffers evil in hell. Jesus puts that kind of reversal right into the words of Abraham himself. There were clues about these reversals, you know, those dogs licking the sores of Lazarus said something's going on here, that it may not end the way it started. Yet, as I looked at the text again, I wondered if there might not be another way to let this text speak the truth of Jesus other than the flip-flops at the end of the story. Who knows, maybe we might even discover that this story has something to say to us beyond the dangers of being rich and how tough it is for the poor and the chasm between the two. Let me suggest that some things stay the same in the story, and that sameness might be a clue to a deeper understanding of the meaning of the parable. This is the only parable, as most of you know, where Jesus actually names one of the characters in the parable. He chooses the name Lazarus, which from the Hebrew means one whom God helps. Poor, sick, pussy Lazarus is throughout this parable one whom God helps. Lazarus receives grace. Now, if you look real closely at the text, it's there when it lets us know that he had some friends who laid him there at the door of the rich man. He didn't just lay there. He was placed there by some friends. And there is the grace even of these dogs that have that sterile saliva that help him with his sores and his wounds. And there's the grace of angels who take this poor man to heaven. And the grace and the comfort of healing and wholeness when he gets to heaven. Lazarus receives grace. He's a beggar throughout the story. One who doesn't receive anything from the rich man, but who receives something from just about everybody else mentioned in the story. Lazarus, going back to our opening story, was not a self-made man. And that brings us to the constancy of the other character, the rich man. What stays the same with him? Remember Lizzie's question? If he really is a self-made man, why'd he make himself that way? The rich man was a self-made man. He is consistent throughout the story. He doesn't need God. He certainly doesn't need Lazarus. Clothes and money become for him symbols of how he has done well on his own. And dear Lizzie, if you want to know why this fellow finds, well, why he made himself that way, well, the answer is he loves himself that way. He loves all the trappings. He loves honoring himself. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Problem of Pain, gave us this. The characteristic of lost souls is their rejection of everything that is not simply themselves. So in the end, guess what the rich man is left with? That which he values most. Himself. Just himself. Himself alone. And that, friends, is hell. So maybe just underneath all these reversals is some constancy that has a lot to say about the text. A blessed constancy for Lazarus, if there ever was one. And a cursed constancy, if there ever was one, for the man who made himself. The story, then, at least from this perspective, is all about grace. Receiving it or thinking we don't need it. But also, it sounds a caution for all of us as we play with being self-made men and women ourselves. For instance, we who sit at the gourmet table of theology in the rich linen of alb and surplice, we can become self-congratulatory and wear our labels of confessional, conservative, like symbols of our own worldly wisdom rather than gifts of grace. We can become a gated community of confessional Christians, keeping as many people out as we can rather than inviting as many in as possible. Or we can sit around the table and chuckle at the theologically poor and leave them for the dogs, so to speak. We can go it alone. We can go it alone here, thinking we don't need the encouragement of friends. We can have a marriage in pretty deep trouble and seek no encouragement from another. We can have a child in pretty deep trouble and tell ourselves, a child of mine, a privileged child of mine, would never have problems like that. There are plenty of do-it-yourselfers around here, and there are plenty of do-it-yourselfers out in the field as pastors. Pastors who speak of my church and even my table. Pastors can pray little and lean little on the Lord. Separate themselves from colleagues, never go to conferences, never bother to encourage a brother pastor at all. We become isolados, to borrow a term from Herman Melville. In a deluge of grace, Sunday by Sunday, self-driven clerics and their self-aggrandized dispensing of grace can never open themselves to grace, even a smidgen of it. We may do it all out there for approval, for recognition, for getting ahead in the church, for a larger parish, for a bigger paycheck, for people who will finally appreciate the gifted pastor they have. We can wear the office the way Dives wore his designer clothes. I know this really isn't a question of heaven or hell, but we certainly play with hell whenever we try to go it alone in ministry. Presidents and preachers can dangle their feet over the fire and wonder why they get burned. We can even separate ourselves as we're so busy with the ministry from those we love the most, our spouse and our children, and years pass, and we wonder where the time went and how the kids grew up so quickly as we built our empire, our testimony to self. Samuel Taylor Coleridge comes to mind. At the funeral of his wife, Coleridge said, "Oh, but if I could have 5 minutes so that I might tell her all." How strangely that sounds like the regrets of the rich man in hell. And congregations are not much different sometimes. They can spend an awful lot of time congratulating themselves on their facilities, their programs, their gifted staffs, their ever-expanding numbers. They can wind up looking like museums or mega malls, but it doesn't make any difference. They can sometimes get awfully self-congratulatory. Oh yes, let it be said that we can play the self-made seminary student or professor, the self-made pastor, and the self-made church. Or if we listen carefully, we can hear the whisper of an echo of a Martin Franzman who once preached at the installation of a young exegete as professor of this place. He said simply to that young professor, "You are and remain together with us all a beggar before God." Somebody ought to stick that on a plaque somewhere around here. You are together with us all a beggar before God. So pardon this next move. I know that you're prone to watch every move we homiletics teachers make in the pulpit, but I would leap to another story and another Lazarus from history, not from parable, and say we could all use a little Lazarus come forth, or maybe a big Lazarus come forth, calling the Lazarus out of each of us that recognizes that we are nothing apart from Christ, and that left to ourselves, we only have ourselves. So it would be good if we could shed the fancy duds that smack of brilliance and achievement and have us feeling so good all over and so great all under. And let the Lazarus in each of us come out that says, "I've been a beggar since my baptism, and a beggar I'll be." That Lazarus needs to come forth. And really, I have to tell you, it's not mine to summon that Lazarus out of you. It's not any of our task to do that. That belongs to one who, though he was rich, yet for our sakes became poor, that we who were poor might, through him, become rich. Now, this is a self-made man, the one who chose to become a beggar for you and for me, who willingly humbled himself and took the form of a servant and begged himself all the way to death. And if you're wondering why in the world he would make himself that way, the answer is what I think is at the center of this text: pure, unadulterated grace. He's the one who summons Lazarus the beggar to come from each of us. Along the way, here and out there in ministry, you may be blessed, as Lazarus was, with a few good friends, maybe even with a nice pooch who has a good lick on your face, maybe even with angels who accompany you all the way. But nothing will compare with pure, unadulterated grace. Amen. And God's peace, which passes all understanding, keep us strong in our faith to everlasting life. Amen.